Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist and author Anthony Arnaud, who assesses the viability of the new Iraqi government's reconciliation plan. Marixi Mercado of UNICEF, who discusses the humanitarian crisis that has resulted from an international aid cutoff in the occupied Palestinian territories. And Heather Boucher, an economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who looks at the congressional debate on raising the federal minimum wage. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Bush administration is engaged in an aggressive diplomatic campaign to stop Venezuela from winning a seat on the United Nations Security Council. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has pressured Latin American nations to actively oppose Venezuela's bid for a two-year seat on the Security Council in an effort to isolate populist President Hugo Chavez. Instead, the Bush administration is supporting its ally Guatemala to fill the seat allotted to Latin America. The BBC has obtained a U.S. diplomatic note that insisted the Chavez government would seek to disrupt the working of the Security Council and use it for ideological grandstanding rather than constructive problem-solving. Venezuela's foreign minister, Ali Rodriguez, countered, "We will use our position to support peace and refuse all kinds of attacks on peaceful countries." According to the Los Angeles Times, Rice has already offered to sell Chile, a close American economic ally, F-16 fighter jets, but will refuse to train the pilots if the South American country votes to back Venezuela's bid. Chile's ambassador to the United Nations, Geraldo Munoz, says the country has remained independent from American influence by opposing the Iraq War and backing the International Criminal Court to investigate war crimes. 10 days after the last Israeli forces withdrew from the Gaza Strip, a small group of American Jewish leaders and several American Protestant officials visited the East Jerusalem headquarters of Sabil, a Palestinian liberation theology center run by Palestinian Christian activist Reverend Naim Atik, who became a controversial figure amongst his guests. Rabbi Gary Breton Granitor of the Anti-Defamation League pressed the Palestinian cleric on accepting Israel's right to exist, which he dodged. The ADL also complained about the writings of Atik's, accusing him of anti-Semitism. According to The Nation magazine, this confrontational meeting came at the end of a trip to bridge the growing divide between American Jews and mainline Protestant denominations. The rift was caused by the 2004 decision by the Presbyterian Church USA to divest itself of companies doing business in Israel which profit from the occupation of Palestinian territories. The United Church of Christ followed suit by adopting a similar policy which prompted outrage in the mainstream Jewish community. The World Council of Churches praised the divestment effort, while other Protestant churches like the Lutherans sought a middle ground. Meanwhile, some Christian denominations are frustrated with inaction after decades of resolutions calling for Israel to leave occupied Palestinian land. Presbyterian divestment advocate Donald Wagner contends, "It's time to say we are not going to benefit from other people's suffering." The London-based Guardian newspaper reports 500 million people who live in desert regions across the globe may find life increasingly difficult as temperatures rise and rainfall levels decrease. A report by the United Nations Environment Programme concludes that desert cities like Phoenix, Arizona and Riyadh, Saudi Arabia are living on borrowed time as water tables sink and rising salt levels make daily life increasingly difficult. Overall, the growing intensity of global warming and resulting climate change are the biggest threat to people and ecology of settlements near deserts, which seem to be suffering a greater impact than other regions. For example, the rainfall in Iran has declined 16% since 1980 near the Dasht-e-Kabir desert. Meanwhile, massive glaciers are melting, with an expected 40-80% decline in South Asia in the next century. The loss of the glaciers, which provide water to Bangladesh, Pakistan, China and India, will have a devastating effect on the populations. Andres Warren of the University College London, one of the UN report's authors, stated, we risk not only losing astounding landscapes and ancient cultures, but also wild species that may hold the key to our survival. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Last week, Congress debated bills relating to setting a timetable for a U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. The Republican-controlled Senate voted 87-13 to reject a measure that called for troops to withdraw from Iraq by July 2007. The Senate also rejected by a 60-39 vote a non-binding resolution that called for a withdrawal of troops, but with no specific timetable. A week earlier, the House had voted 256-153 for a Republican measure that stated the U.S. should stay in Iraq until its mission is completed. Although Republicans had charged Democrats with advocating a cut-and-run policy, the top U.S. military commander in Iraq has himself drafted a timetable for withdrawing up to 7,000 American troops by September. Meanwhile, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki put forth a 24-point national reconciliation initiative on June 25th, offering amnesty to insurgents who renounce violence and have not engaged in terrorist attacks. Press reports indicated that some Sunni insurgent groups had expressed interest in discussing the plan with the government. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with journalist Anthony Arnov, whose latest book is titled Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. He assesses the political debate in Washington and the viability of the new Iraqi government's reconciliation plan.
It's fairly interesting that the polls show a majority of people in this country opposed to this war. Polls also show a majority of soldiers, active duty troops on the ground in Iraq, wanting to withdraw. And really, the Democrats have failed to provide any coherent proposal for withdrawal. There was division between Democrats who wanted to stay the course, some Democrats who even want to send more troops to Iraq, such as Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, but others who advocate various positions that would involve some form of timetable. I, in my book, argue for immediate withdrawal rather than a prolonged timetable for withdrawal, but at least the idea of withdrawal was beginning to be aired. It's not surprising that Congress rejected that proposal, and it leaves us in a situation where I think we have to take very seriously the idea that this occupation will continue, quite likely, into the next administration. George Bush has said it's not up to him to decide when troops will leave Iraq, and an aide to Tony Blair, who's Bush's main ally in the occupation of Iraq, Britain has the second largest number of troops in Iraq, if you exclude private security firms, after the United States. He has a top aide who said that their scenario is staying in Iraq until 2010. So I'm not overly confident that the pressure that we now see building in Congress is going to lead to any kind of immediate resolution. I think it's going to take much more popular pressure to bring that about.
In other developments around Iraq, the new Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki has put forth a reconciliation plan that includes some amnesty for insurgents. Details are not all that clear at this moment, but what do you make of this plan? And is there any chance, as some press reports have suggested, that the insurgents are ready to sit down and talk?
Well, I'm skeptical. I think that this is more media hype than it is substance. We've seen a number of efforts of the Bush administration and the Iraqi government to say that we're turning a corner. This amnesty offer or this constitutional election or this referendum is going to end the violence and the instability and the insurgency in Iraq. And after every one of these turning points, the reality is it's only continued to get worse in Iraq. This May, the number of bodies that showed up in the Baghdad morgue was double the number from May 2005. In the first 6 months of this year, attacks against the coalition forces averaged 600 a week. That's up 13% from the end of 2005. And sectarian divisions have increased in the country. And really, I don't think al-Maliki's proposal gets at the root of the problem, which is that Iraqis overwhelmingly object to foreign occupation. And as long as the U.S. troops are there, as long as the U.S. is building military bases, as long as the U.S. is building its largest embassy in the world in Baghdad, and as long as effectively the U.S. is calling the shots economically, militarily, politically, which they are, the resistance, the opposition, the violence is going to continue.
Anthony, tell us a little bit about the influence, if any, that peace groups and anti-war Iraq veterans organizations have had on the course of the war policy in Washington and what they may be able to do in the coming months as the midterm congressional elections approach.
Well, I think that's a crucial question. I think the peace movement, the veterans movement, has already had a significant impact. There's no question that the debate that's now happening in Congress came about as a result of the opinion polls, the popular pressure that Congress is beginning to feel, the polls that show a majority now opposing the war, that show George Bush having the lowest approval rating of any president in modern history, other than Richard Nixon at the height of the Watergate scandal, and showing that people oppose actually both the Democrats and Republicans' stance on the war. So there's a situation where I think we've begun to have an impact. We've shifted public opinion. We've shifted the nature of the debate in this country. Much more needs to be done, and I'm particularly encouraged that groups like Iraq Veterans Against War, the group of veterans from this conflict modeled on Vietnam Veterans Against the War, is out there mobilizing, giving voice to soldiers who've been in Iraq, who've seen firsthand the horrors of this occupation, and who are speaking out against it. And they have three very simple demands: immediate withdrawal of troops, reparations for the Iraqi people, which I think is a very important demand to be coupled with the idea of withdrawal so that we don't just abandon the Iraqis, and also money to be spent on veterans. You know, this government says support our troops, by which they only mean support the government that needlessly sends our troops in harm's way. Don't provide them with education or health care or jobs or any of the things that they're promised when they enlist. Don't actually support the troops in any meaningful sense, but send them off to die. And so it's important to talk about those issues. And I'm also encouraged that people are making connections between civil liberties issues at home, the war on immigrants and poor people and working people, and the war on our civil liberties that's gone hand in hand with this war in Iraq.
That was journalist Anthony Arnov, whose latest book is titled Iraq: The Logic of Withdrawal. Read his articles online at www.zmag.org. Violence and hardship have escalated in the Palestinian territories, Gaza and the West Bank, since Hamas came to power in March of this year. Hamas does not recognize Israel's right to exist, and the international community responded with an aid cutoff. However, Hamas is now in negotiations with Fatah, its political rival, over a document that would recognize Israel's right to exist and negotiate a two-state solution. Tensions have increased during the month of June, with the killing of at least 20 Palestinian civilians, as well as the assassination of two Palestinian militants in Gaza by the Israeli Defense Force. On June 25th, Palestinian militants, including members of Hamas, tunneled into Israel underneath a Gaza border crossing in retaliation, they said, for recent Israeli attacks, and killed two Israeli soldiers and captured another. Israel has vowed that Palestinians will pay a heavy price for this incursion, especially if the soldier is not returned unharmed. After the attack, Israel closed the border crossings, the only way people and goods can enter or exit the territory. Previous closings have created widespread hardships. Gaza is home to 1.3 million people crammed onto 140 square miles, much of it desert, less than a tenth the size of Rhode Island. Children suffer disproportionately from the violence and from the lack of food and medical care. UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, released a statement in mid-June, warning that one in three newborns in Gaza is at risk of dying due to the lack of medicines and emergency medical equipment in hospitals. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Marixi Mercado, communications officer with UNICEF's humanitarian aid programs in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, or OPT. She describes the current crisis and explains what UNICEF does in Palestine to improve the lives of children in the current climate.
I've just actually come back from the territory about 2 weeks ago, and I can tell you that in May, central stocks of like some critical medicines were at or near zero levels in central warehouses. What UNICEF has done, particularly with respect to health, in particular to deal with that, we've procured, I think, about $1.2 million worth of essential drugs and medicines for the over 400 primary health clinics and 17 general hospitals in Gaza. And these supplies and equipment include a whole array of supplies and materials, particularly for the neonatal units in the 17 general hospitals within the territories. And so basically we've identified newborn mortality as a huge issue, and we're bringing in the drugs and the supplies that are needed to really deal with it. I mean, if I think, as I was briefed a little bit on this by a doctor, and what he told me was that essentially that the primary reasons for death are prematurity and low birth weight, and that basically essentially with good hospital facilities, all children who are born with these conditions can make it, but under current circumstances, because of the lack of facilities to, for example, maintain regular body temperature or maintain good breathing or drugs to to treat complications, these are why mortality rates are rising now.
We hear a lot in the U.S. about all the Qassam rockets that the Palestinians in Gaza are firing into Israel, and they've injured a few people, but I don't think they've killed anyone, as far as I know. But I just read an article in the New York Times that indicated Israel is firing a lot more into Gaza than vice versa, and at least 19 Palestinian civilians, including many children, have been killed in the past month by Israeli shelling.
In the last 3 months, Palestinians have fired 479 homemade rockets towards Israel, and during the same period, the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, have fired 7,599 artillery shells into the Gaza Strip.
So what kind of impact from that shelling is UNICEF dealing with?
Basically, you're living in the context of constant shelling. This is something that you hear all the time. You don't even blink anymore. It's just the context of extraordinary violence and insecurity, particularly for kids. I mean, there's an increasing risk, I understand, of kids coming into contact with unexploded ordnance because of areas, for example, that in Gaza had been previously closed off to them, which are now open to them. It's something that has been going on for a long, long time. It's just now that things have escalated now.
Marixi Mercado, what does UNICEF do exactly in the occupied Palestinian territories?
UNICEF procures the entire vaccine requirement along with a wide range of essential drugs and supplies. With our partners on the ground, we conduct immunization campaigns and provide services that reach areas without health clinics. We upgrade facilities, train health workers, and help deal with new threats like avian flu. We help make sure that children can keep studying despite checkpoints, closures, and other military activity. We've developed these remedial worksheets in math, science, Arabic, and English that basically allow students who are forced to stay home to either keep up with their studies, or when they get to school and the teachers can't get there to continue studying anyway. We've worked with communities across the territory to develop safe play areas where basically young people can be young. I mean, they're living in a context of extraordinary violence, and there are not a lot of safe places for them to just be young. And so working with communities, we've established, I think, 41 safe play areas across the territories. And in these places, we have trained animators who give guidance and can help them develop skills, that go from computer literacy to drama. And I guess the other key thing that we do is we have 12 psychosocial teams across Gaza and the West Bank who work with parents and children to help them deal with the overwhelming level of conflict-induced stress. And particularly during emergencies, these teams, they visit homes and hospitals.
If restrictions to Palestinians' movement are not eased and Palestinian government workers can't get paid soon, and food and medical care made more easily available, what is your prognosis for Palestinian children and all civilians in the occupied territories?
The humanitarian outlook not just for Gaza, but for the entire occupied Palestinian territory, it looks extremely bleak, and it's predicted to worsen dramatically.
That was Marixi Mercado of UNICEF. For more information on UNICEF's work in Palestine, call area code 212-326-7261 or visit www.unicef.org. In the lead-up to this November's midterm election, Congress is debating an increase in the minimum wage, which has been unchanged since 1997. Senate Democrats had proposed raising the federal minimum wage from the current $5.15 an hour to $7.25 by January 2009. But the Republican-controlled Senate killed the proposal with a vote of 52-46, 8 short of the 60 needed for passage. Workers earning minimum wage make about $10,700 a year, only $900 above the official government poverty level. Advocates of a hike in the minimum wage say that an increase to a $7.25 hourly rate would put more than $4,000 in the pockets of 6.5 million Americans. Despite a freeze in the minimum wage for the last 9 years, 21 states and the District of Columbia have set the minimum wage above the federal level of $5.15. Opinion polls indicate the public overwhelmingly supports a minimum wage increase. While GOP leaders in the House of Representatives have opposed the measure, election year pressure may force the issue for a vote before the summer recess. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Heather Boucher, an economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who looks at the congressional debate on raising the federal minimum wage.
If we don't raise the minimum wage by December, that'll be the longest period of time over which we have not raised the minimum wage since the minimum wage was established as part of the Fair Labor Standards Act. So the fact that the House and the Senate are trying to move on this is very important, because that's certainly a goal we'd like to meet.
As you read editorials and different articles on the issue of the minimum wage being raised, there's a lot of discussion about the effect on the economy. There are some conservative economists who say a minimum wage makes it harder on employers, which in turn would make it more difficult to hire large numbers of people, depressing the economy. But of course, there are others who say it will be a boon to the economy. What's your read of the effect of the minimum wage?
Well, I think that overall it would be good for the economy. If we raise the federal minimum wage to $7.25 per hour over the next couple of years, as opposed, which was proposed in the bill, that would raise the annual earnings of the average full-time, full-year minimum wage worker by a little over $1,500 a year. And we know that folks who are at the bottom end of the income spectrum, if you give them an extra dollar, they'll go out and spend it. So those families will have an extra $1,500 a year to go out and spend on goods and services. That's enough to afford about 9 months' worth of groceries for those families, or a whole host of other goods. So that really would be good for low-wage communities and for the businesses that serve those families. And, you know, one of the other questions that people always ask, or that one of the criticisms, is that if you raise the minimum wage, employers are going to have to lay a bunch of people off. And that certainly has not been the case in the past. That's not what we've seen. And right now, the majority of Americans live in a state that has a minimum wage higher than the federal minimum, and we haven't seen a huge disemployment effect from those movements. So certainly, if we raise the minimum wage, it would put more money in the hands of people who will spend it, and it's likely to improve their economic well-being and add to their ability to spend without creating disemployment.
Heather, tell us a little bit about who makes the minimum wage now. A lot of conservative pundits, Rush Limbaugh comes to mind, say, well, it's just kids, just, you know, 16-year-olds who make minimum wage. But from my read of the statistics, that's not exactly true.
No, it's not true. And while it is true, of course, that a lot of teenagers do earn the minimum wage, a lot of people who are working their way through college earn the minimum wage, it is true that 50%, over half, of minimum wage workers are between the ages of 25 and 54. That is, they're prime age workers, they're adults. So over half of minimum wage workers are adults. And among those who earn the minimum wage, they contribute a little bit over two-thirds of their total family income. So among, you know, all the households, all the families that have a minimum wage worker, that minimum wage worker is a significant contributor to the total family income. The third point is that among prime-age workers, those folks between 25 and 54, about a third of them are still stuck in a minimum wage job 3 years later. So there's not a lot of mobility out of minimum wage jobs. There's certainly not as much mobility as the folks who are against raising the minimum wage would like to suggest. If a third of folks who are earning at the minimum wage are still in minimum wage jobs 3 years later, and these are adults, again, prime-age workers, that really does signify an important problem that having such a low minimum wage sets for these workers and their families. But it also goes against the criticism that it doesn't really affect a lot of families or that it's just teenagers or something. These are real sort of working adults, and they're having a hard time moving out of those jobs.
We have many indications that there is a growing disparity between rich and poor in the United States, unlike we've seen in many decades. How does the minimum wage fit into this picture? Does it significantly alter the downward spiral in terms of this gap between the wealthy and the poorest in the country?
Well, the minimum wage is a floor, right? It's the bottom of the wage distribution. And what we've seen over the past few years is that the minimum wage is at its lowest point in 50 years. Inequality is at one of its highest points, if not its highest point. And the gap between the median worker and the minimum wage worker is also at a historic high. So you're seeing an increased dispersion of incomes and of wages, so that some folks have benefited during this economic recovery, those at the very top of the wage distribution, while minimum wage workers have only seen their real take-home pay decline over the past few years. Of course, it's also true that median family income in America today is lower than it was back at the end of the last recovery in 1999. The lack of maintaining a solid floor for the bottom end of the labor market has been a very important part of this increasing economic inequality that we've been seeing over the past few decades.
That was Heather Boucher, an economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Contact the center by calling area code 202-293-5380. Or visit their website at www.cepr.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.